Hello, I'm Bruce Celery. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple. Dog, cat, ferret, rabbit, turtle, hamster, guinea pig, whatever pet you've got, there will be love and there will be bills. Dr. Matthew Richardson is a veterinarian. He's the owner of the Animal Clinic in Toronto, and he's the president of the Ontario Veterinary Medical Association. He is here to help us understand the budget you need in order to support your pet. Some people prefer to grow their family by getting a pet. Others want to have kids. And it's no surprise that raising a child can be really, really expensive. So how do you know if you're ready financially? How do you prepare for it? What are the costs you need to think about? Sandy Yong will be here to talk about that. She is a personal finance writer, TEDx and keynote speaker, and the author of The Money Master. She's got the latest from a piece she did for Money Sense on the cost of raising a kid in Canada today. Then going on dates with your significant other is great and all, but have you ever been on a money date? Yeah, it's a thing. This is something that you can do with your partner. You can even do it with yourself to help you focus on what is going to make the biggest difference to get a handle on your money. Vanessa Bowen is a chartered professional accountant. She's a money coach and the founder of Mintworthy. She's here to talk about how money dates work, plus investing in dividend-paying stocks. Pavi Tour will be here to talk about his book, Learn to Invest, Kid. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple, brought to you in part by Credit Canada, the first and longest-standing nonprofit credit counseling agency in the country. Let's get started. Dog person, cat person, bunny, ferret, turtle, guinea pig, gerbil, a hamster, whatever kind of person you are, if you are thinking about adding a cute little furry or scaly something to your family, you should know it comes with a cost. But just how much do you need to budget when it comes to bringing in and caring for a pet? To take a closer look at some of these costs, we're joined by Dr. Matthew Richardson. He is a veterinarian and owner of the Animal Clinic in Toronto. He is also the president of the Ontario Veterinary Medical Association. Hello there.
Hello, Bruce. How are you?
This is both a really practical conversation. We're going to talk about numbers and an irrelevant conversation. And I say irrelevant because I now have a cat and I would probably mortgage my own house for his care. So there's this theoretical, like, let's talk about the money. But really, I would, you know, remove my own kidneys to pay for something for my ridiculous cat. How would you put this conversation in context? Because I think a lot of pet owners are like me, like this is not a rational, logical discussion when it comes to caring for a pet.
Fair enough. I mean, we get pets because we want that unconditional love that they provide. We like, there's often something about, you know, the way they look or the way they act or a thing that they do that we find absolutely endearing. And you know, once we get it in our minds that this is what we want, it can be really hard to sort of think about the practical aspect, which is, you know, can I afford this pet and does it fit with my lifestyle? Both of which I think are really important questions that ideally people would be asking before they got their heart set on something.
There is the initial cost. You could adopt a pet either informally or through a rescue, and then there are breeders. So the spectrum is quite wide in terms of that. What is the most expensive breed or, I don't know, pet expense you have ever seen? Like, is my chin going to drop to the floor here?
Probably. I mean, there are some sort of boutique breeds, I would call them. Things like fluffy French bulldogs, which are, you know, depending on where you get them from, I have seen quoted anywhere from $5,000 to $25,000 for a single individual. You know, those would be sort of the extreme things, and they tend to follow social media popularity to some extent, I think.
And novelness
and newness, right?
Right.
Often they're the must-have pet of the cabbage patch pet, if you will.
Right. So I'm gonna divide our costs into three categories. The initial purchase that kind of gets set, you know, year one kind of thing, and then some of the ongoing costs of owning a pet, but it focused on veterinary care because we know there is food and grooming and dog walking and cat sitting and, you know, all those sorts of things. That first year, there can be shots and spaying and neutering and all that stuff. Broadly speaking, how much should people think about for that first year?
So for the first year, I would say, you know, you're probably looking, depending on the age, a lot of it depends on the age you get your pet at and what the breeder has done in advance of you adopting it, right? So generally speaking, dogs and cats would have three sets of boosters somewhere around the 8, 12, and 16 week marks. You know, and so if your pet has had all of those shots beforehand, that's going to be, you know, fewer expenses for you. But I would say, generally speaking, you should be thinking of, you know, in the $300 to $500 range for those vaccines, deworming, fecal testing to make sure they don't have any parasites, that sort of thing. Depends also, is it going to be if it's a dog, you probably need to think about parasite medications, depending on their lifestyle and where they're going to go. If they're a outdoor cat, you need to think about flea and parasite medications for them as right. well. Things like microchipping. And then the neuter and spay can vary widely, depending on whether, I probably at one end of the spectrum, you would have something like going to a spay neuter clinic where it would be relatively inexpensive, all the way up to, laparoscopic spays, which are sort of the cutting edge of spay neuter care right. these days. And those would be, you know, I don't know those numbers off the top of my head because that's not a service that I provide.
But more.
It's considerably more.
So then as you think about the ongoing, I'm going to make a guess that many pets are reasonably healthy from, let's say many cats and dogs are reasonably helpful from, 1 to 10 years old. So if we say that there's an aging period in which there may be more cost for that period of time, and you may say it's a different age range, what should people think about in terms of veterinary care on an annual basis, provided your dog does not get into chocolate? There is no fight at the dog park. There is no, cataracts early. What should you think about in terms of an annual cost?
I think, generally speaking, I would recommend 1 to 2 visits to the vet every year just for a checkup. Make sure everything looks good. Everything is, there's no concerns. There's no abnormal lumps, bumps, dental issues, ear infections, things that sometimes sort of fly under the radar with people. Depending on the lifestyle of the pet and the home life of the pet, if there are young kids in the house, I very strongly encourage all dogs to have a fecal test done once a year because parasites can be passed from from pets to humans, and our little humans aren't always the best at respecting certain boundaries on our pets, and aren't the best at recognizing good hand hygiene, right? So fecal testing, some blood testing, and parasite medication. I mean, I would think people should be thinking a number around $1,000 a year for all of that would be my,
and then there are all the exceptions, which you see all the time, because people bring you their pets for maintenance, for checkups, but they also bring you pets who need acute care. What advice do you have for people to think through those? How to think through those expenses in what is just can be such a deeply emotional time. And there is, the quality of life for the pet is a factor. The cost is a factor. The prognosis is a factor. I'm sure there are many other factors that I haven't even thought of. What advice do you go to time and again to help provide people some guidance?
It can be a tricky time. And I would say, one of the challenges. What makes it a challenge, I think, and it's becoming more and more of a challenge as time goes on, is that we're really blessed in veterinary medicine that we are now starting to have a lot of the diagnostic modalities and treatment modalities that used to be only seen in human health, right? So if I have a, let's say I have a dog come in and I think it slipped a disc in its back and it's, it has the possibility of permanent neurologic damage to its back legs from that, there's a very good chance that they could get an MRI done in the next 24 to 48 hours at a few different hospitals in Toronto. But it's no secret that MRI machines are expensive and maintenance is expensive and all of that. So that type of care comes with a huge expense, right? And so, no one gets a pet hoping that they're going to have some sort of bad disease, right? Or catastrophic injury. But the catastrophic and bad things do unfortunately happen. And when they do, they often need to be treated quite promptly, right? So if your dog has a, well, we'll just keep using that same example. If your dog has a slipped disc in its back, the sooner it gets surgery, the better the prognosis is for it to go back to being able to walk properly again, right? Unfortunately, having a dog with a slipped disc who needs an MRI and then back surgery, and physiotherapy and all of that, it's, that those prices get well in excess of $10,000, which a lot of people don't have handy, right? So I am very slowly coming around to answer your question, which is that I think pet insurance is a great thing to have. No one wants to have to use it. And if we don't, we'll complain about the cost we spend for it. But when we need it, it's really nice to have that assurance that the money is there, so that we can take care of our pets without worrying about that at the time when we need to make the tough decisions.
The knock I have heard on pet insurance is around exclusions. So this, for someone who has health insurance or disability insurance, we know that there are certain rules and requirements. It's not like universal health care where you can go into any emergency room and they'll treat you. What should people be aware of in terms of what pet insurance will and will not cover? And I don't mean by policy. I mean, broadly speaking, it doesn't cover everything all the time to an unlimited sum.
Correct. And that's a great point. It's a bit difficult to talk about generalities because there are various different pet insurance plans, and each one is built slightly differently, right? So I sort of joke with my clients that they're like, pet insurance plans are a lot like cell phone plans, and they're all just ever so slightly different, so you can't compare them very effectively, right? But invariably, the insurance company will ask to see the pet's medical history. They will look at what's happened in the past and sometimes go all the way back through the whole medical record to figure out what things should be excluded and not. Right? So if your dog has been in, for a limp, let's say 2 weeks ago, and then it comes in, and then it got a little bit better, and then it comes in again and it's limping even worse on that leg, they're probably, and in the interim you've picked up pet insurance, they're probably going to say that's a pre-existing condition and we're not going to cover it. Which, it's not surprising. They have to make sure that they're offering a policy that they can support, right? So my general recommendation is that it's a good idea to get pet insurance when you've got a young dog with who's got a clean bill of health. So you get a puppy or a kitten, you take it to the vet, and they look it over, and if they give it a clean bill of health, then there probably will not be any exclusions outside of whatever they exclude from the policy. Lots of policies don't include the consultation fee. So when you come in and you have your exam, a lot of policies won't include that. So that's something to be aware of. A lot of policies, and this is a big one, a lot of policies have very discrete rules about what they'll cover for dentistry, right? So if your dog has You know, if your dog needs a dental cleaning, most policies don't cover just a dental cleaning. They'll cover extractions of teeth for fractures, but
Right.
not for other things, right? So, you know, it's important to read the policy and see what it is, but really the way to avoid exclusions is to get it from the get-go.
I want to sneak in one last question before we go here. What options do people have if they can't afford these costs? Are there supports out there?
There are some. So, you know, number one would be, you know, if pet insurance isn't a possibility and family members aren't a possibility, there are things like credit care where people can apply, much like getting a credit card or a line of credit, but it's just for healthcare costs. There are, you know, obviously humane societies, there are places like that. One big one that I would like to put a plug in for, because not everyone knows about it, is that the Ontario Veterinary Medical Association has a charity called the Farley Foundation. And the Farley Foundation provides small but significant funding to help people on social assistance, and people in households with an income of less than $25,000, with necessary. So it won't cover, you know, your annual and your vaccines, but if your dog or cat has a or other pet has a health concern and you fall into one of the categories, your vet can apply for some supplemental funding to help pay for that, which is a
Interesting.
really good way to try and keep pets in the household, which
The
is
Farley
obviously what we
Foundation.
always wanted to do. The Farley Foundation.
Great. Dr. Richardson, thank you for your time today. We really
My
appreciate it.
pleasure.
Dr. Matthew Richardson is a veterinarian and owner of the Animal Clinic in Toronto. He is also the president of the Ontario Veterinary Medical Association. Coming up next on Moo La La, how much it costs to raise a child in Canada. Personal finance writer Sandy Young is here to break it down for us. And later, we'll speak with Vanessa Bowen. She is a money coach, founder of Mintworthy, a frequent guest on this show. And she's going to talk about how to have a money date with your partner. If you want the latest and greatest Moo La La has to offer, and we've got a lot to offer, you can sign up for our newsletter. At moolala.ca. That's the website, moolala.ca. Sign up for the newsletter once a month, never more. Once a month, we send a newsletter out with all the stuff that we're doing on this radio show on SiriusXM, on CBC Radio and CityLine, and provide you with more tips and tricks and inspiration and insight to help you get a better handle on your money. Moo La La, Money Made Simple, is brought to you in part by Credit Canada. I am the CEO of the organization, and we are Canada's longest-standing nonprofit credit counseling agency. Our mission is to help people get out of debt so they can get back into life. Listen, debt is a brutal reality for millions of Canadians. It starts to pile on for lots and lots of different reasons: job loss, divorce, illness, bad luck, you name it. Our accredited credit counselors are available to help you understand your current financial situation and take you through all your options on how to move forward. And there really are options out there. So go to creditcanada.com. We are nonprofit. As I said, the counseling is free and judgment-free. The cost of living has gone up in almost every category of your life. Earlier on the program, we talked about how much it costs to care for a pet these days. It's a big number. But what about a baby that becomes a toddler, that becomes a child, that becomes a teen? It's a big number there too, even bigger number. Sandy Yong is a personal finance writer, TEDx and keynote speaker, the author of The Money Master, and she recently wrote a piece for Money Sense about how much it costs to raise a child in Canada in today's day and age. She joins us now for more on that. Hello there.
Hi, Bruce. Thanks for having me today.
Okay, so give us the big picture here. What is the average cost that you calculated? And is it best to look at it on an annual basis, or did you do that thing where you total it from 0 to 18 when we can make the I shouldn't say assumption. We can have the hope that the kid might be off the payroll. 18's too young. No, the kid's not going to be off the payroll till 23, I can't imagine. So how did you think about the average cost?
Yes, so when I wrote this piece for Money Sense, there was an actual study that started in 2011. And we took that as the foundation and factored in inflation for over a decade now and really looked at how much families spend. And so on an annual basis from zero to up to age 18, a family with two parents and two kids will spend an average of just under $17,000 per year, which is quite substantial.
What did you notice about how things had changed since 2011? Like, obviously there's inflation on everything, but not at the same rate. Surely there were things that rose faster than others when you look back.
Of course. And I think the one category that has changed significantly over the past few years would be childcare. And what I mean by that is that the federal government has launched the National Childcare Program, where they're really helping to assist families to pay for the cost of daycare. And so we're kind of in the middle of it right now. We're looking to have families be reimbursed by up to 50% on average for the cost of childcare. And hopefully by 2026, the national average will be about $10 per day.
Wow. Now, as you think about those costs, and we break it down into different chunks, you could say there are upfront costs or costs that you pay in those first couple of years. There are some that are ongoing. How do you break them up into different categories?
For sure. Yes. So if you are a parent who's expecting a newborn, the most common upfront costs would be ensuring that you have a crib or a place for a baby to sleep, having a stroller to get around. And then if you have a car, you want to ensure that you have a car seat because safety first. And then other items like having a high chair for when you have meals together, feeding supplies, or even a baby carrier. So these are costs that are typically one-time investments. And then once you have them, then they're there for you. Whereas ongoing costs, you may consider having a subscription for diapers or creams or wipes and even baby formula because you just need this over and over again as your baby grows.
Mm. Anytime you're talking about money, there is this question of needs versus wants. And it is a spectrum. It is very, very personal. As a parent of a baby, I needed a running stroller. Like, that was a need. This was not a want. It was a need. Whereas other people would think I'm insane. Like, why? You don't need that. And what you really need is a baby wipe warmer, which some people tried to tell me that I needed, which I did not need. What wisdom would you have for parents as they try and work out the needs versus want answers on a day-to-day, week-to-week, month-to-month basis?
Yeah, so I think parents can easily go down a rabbit hole when it comes to figuring out what kind of supplies and equipment they need in their life. And you can be easily tempted into buying fancy gadgets. But I think it really boils down to having a conversation with your spouse or partner and deciding what are your priorities and what's important to you and the lifestyle that you have. Because for myself, my husband and I, we realized that it was more convenient for us to have a 360 swiveling car seat. And even though we paid a premium, we found that it has provided a lot of value. Whereas other parents might look at us and say, hey, why did you pay so much for a swiveling car seat? Is it really, do you really need it? But for us, it just comes down to personal choice.
How did you think about some of the less tangible spending that people might bucket under self-care? And I'm a huge believer in this for both parents, but certainly there is often a primary caregiver who's does more of the lifting. It's rarely 50-50 in terms of percentages. How do you think about those expenses? Because those can be so critical in keeping your sanity when you're sleepless.
Yeah, and so you mean for the parents, right?
For the parents, massage, babysitters, I don't know, extracurricular things for the occasional takeout meal so that you can not have to worry about food. I put all those into this broad, very broad category of self-care.
Yeah, I mean, though all those things we have definitely taken advantage of in our household just to make sure that we are able to juggle everything in our lives, just because being parents and having full-time jobs and just balancing all these priorities, it's definitely important to figure out how you're going to take care of yourselves. And even for us, we have health insurance from our employers, and we always take advantage of getting massages and having that reimbursed. And so it's just, for us, it's a great way to just take time for ourselves and to recharge our batteries, because we know as parents, it can be very demanding. And so it's definitely important to take care of yourself.
What have you found in your relationship most helpful in having conversations about money? Because when you throw kids into the mix, there can be a lot of emotions involved. There can be differences in terms of values. How do you navigate that productively?
You know, it's always a great time to review your finances on an ongoing basis, because as your child or children grow up, your expenses will naturally shift to different categories. And so what my husband and I do, we have our Excel spreadsheet, and we just put together a really simple budget of what we think the child care costs will be for the year. And from time to time, you know, we might be in budget, but we might spend a little bit more on clothing or toys, and a little bit less on, say, food items, right? And so having a conversation to kind of forecast or predict what you think you'll spend, even for the next couple of months, will be really helpful to put money aside and work towards your savings goals. Mm-hmm. Even for us, we opened up an RESP for our son, and we had a conversation to see, like, how much do we need to start saving every single month, so that we are working towards future goals and balancing our daily needs as well.
This is a very tangible example of the choices parents need to make between today and tomorrow. So today is, you know, can I afford the diapers? Tomorrow, 20 years down the road, will the kid have money for education? When money is tight, and for millions of families, money is really, really tight, what advice would you have for them in terms of navigating the priority call? Maybe not on the diapers, because that's not really an option, but on, I don't know, Kinder music or girl guides versus the RESP.
Yeah, I mean, we're definitely feeling the pinch as well, especially with the higher cost of living these days. And yeah, when it comes to, say, recreational activities, we try to find a balance between maybe, you know, over the summer, our son can go to a nice soccer camp. And then the winter, we can take him to the science center, or try to get, you know, free passes from our local library. And so I think it's just figuring out and talking to other parents, right? Because there are huge resources as well, finding affordable or even free festivals or local markets that you can go to that really won't break the bank. And then occasionally splurging on some of the fancier, you know, sporting activities or music lessons that your children will also enjoy.
Oh my gosh, I love that you're earlier in the journey. We've now got a 14-year-old, so it's a whole different set of math. I really appreciate, Sandy, you coming to talk to us today.
Thank you so much for having me, Bruce.
Sandy Yong is a personal finance writer, author of The Money Master, and a bit of a master in navigating this parenting personal finance game. She recently wrote a piece for Money Sense, looking at the latest numbers on what it costs to raise a child these days. Coming up later, why you and your partner should consider going on a money date. How fun does that sound? Vanessa Bowen is a money coach. She's founder of Mintworthy. She's here to talk about what would be on the agenda for an event like that. But first, we're going to speak with Pavi Tour. He runs a nonprofit called Young Guns Weightlifting and Boxing Club. But really, he's here to talk about financial literacy and kids and his book, Learn to Invest, Kid. If you are a fan of, well, I don't know, boxing, if you're a fan of lifestyle shows, I'm the money columnist for a program called CityLine, and it is the longest running daytime show in Canada, hosted by Tracy Moore. She's amazing. And if you watch it live, hooray, you can also check out segments on the website at cityline.tv.
Hi, it's me, your debt. Look, we need to talk. This isn't working. The missed payments, the collection calls, and all those sleepless nights. We need nonprofit debt counseling, and I found the perfect place. Credit Canada Debt Solutions. They're non-judgmental, 100% confidential. They'll negotiate with creditors and even stop interest. Don't you want to rebuild your credit? You deserve better.
Break up with debt. Visit creditcanada.com.
We all believe in the possibilities of tomorrow. And at Easy Financial, we're here to help you every step of the way. If the banks aren't an option, we can help get you approved for a loan in as little as 10 minutes. And with our personal, home equity, and auto loans, you can choose the loan that's right for you, so you can start rebuilding your credit for a better tomorrow. Apply today without affecting your credit score at easyfinancial.com or at over 400 locations and find out how much you can qualify for. Easy Financial. Better tomorrows.
We talk a lot about kids and money on this show, and often it's like cash flow and savings and managing debt and all that stuff. But our next guest believes there is a place for investing when it comes to financial literacy for young people. And one particular strategy has caught his attention that he has real passion about, and that's dividend paying stocks. Interesting topic. Our guest, Pavi Tour, he runs a nonprofit called Young Guns Weightlifting and Boxing. He's the author of Learn to Invest, Kid, and he joins us now from Mission, BC. Hello there.
Hi, Bruce. Thanks for having me.
I said the title of the book fairly straight up, but as I read it, it sounds like if I were to say it to my 14-year-old, it would sound like this: Learn to Invest, Kid. So is there pointing that happens when you deliver the title of the book? Like, come on.
Well, that's up to you. I try not to point because my kids are now getting bigger than me. So I try to talk in sort of the advisor role as opposed to the old school dad role.
Sure. We're going to get to the content of the book in a second, but the story starts before that. Tell us about Young Guns.
So Young Guns was started in December 2019, just before the pandemic. And I started it as a free youth weightlifting and boxing club. So it was free for kids, mainly because my own son, who was 15 at the time, the oldest one, he was playing basketball. There was no sort of weightlifting training program for athletes in my area. So either you had a personal trainer, which costs a lot, or you gave your kid a gym pass and they had to figure it out themselves. So we reserved some gym space. We had a personal trainer, worked up to about 15 kids. I was part of the program as well. And just working on the basics to improve athletic performance. And yeah, it took off from there. And to fund it, we sold merchandise, our own club merchandise.
Right. Merch. Okay. So now make the connection here. You obviously had young people hanging around a gym. All that was, I'm sure, turned upside down with the pandemic. How did the book come to be?
Well, it was also during the pandemic, my younger son, who was 13, and this kind of hit me. He came home one day and he was talking about various cryptocurrency and how everybody was investing. And then, Dad, we got to get into GameStop because, well, everyone's making money.
Oh, geez.
And yeah. He was 13. And this was everywhere. Remember at the time it was on, I believe, all these NHL games, all these celebrities were talking about it. No one knew anything about it, but everybody was talking about it. And at that point, I realized, okay, we got to start teaching you, both of you, about investments, about dividends and everything else. And I didn't have all the answers myself. So it started with a problem and, okay, let's write this out. Let's see what sticks. And after many rewrites, and we started off with a blog on learntoinvestkid.com, and we just worked on real short posts, put them up. And then once I lost their attention, we stopped the post. So you'll see through the book, some chapters are shorter than others. Some go into details. And then we use a lot of superhero themes, and we use movie stars, as you've seen in there, sort of what mistakes they've made. So it's not just about successes. It's also about failures, but get these kids to think about long term. So don't tell me what happened last week.
The thing that struck me about the book as being unique from the many that we have covered over the years is this focus on blue chip dividend paying stocks. So there's a lot of general stuff out there, but yeah. I hadn't seen anything that focuses on this particular niche of the investing world. Why do you think it's important for kids to learn about this in particular?
I think it takes sort of the hype away from the investing end of things, like especially in the last little couple of years where everything's on YouTube or TikTok. And it kind of goes back to the basics. Our first stock was Suncor Energy. And the reason why we picked Suncor Energy was every time I had to fill up at the Petro-Canada gas station in town, I always spoke, let's say, colorful French, and the kids would hear it. And yeah. From there they go, oh, so, you know, we get gas. They obviously make profits. Let's start there. So a lot of these stocks, my kids play sports. So they have their favorite sports teams. That was easier to make the connection with them as opposed to just going into ETFs, mutual funds, and everything right away. So they would identify with the companies, the logos, they'd see it everywhere in town. And those are the companies I zeroed in on. So we focused specifically on those companies as opposed to making it broad-based.
Conceptually, it's a big idea. And I love that you're teaching young people about buying a stock that may appreciate over time, but while you wait for that appreciation to occur, you can bring home a dividend. You can have this passive income that's a function of the profitability of the company. That said, not all dividend payers are blue chip. How do you screen for them? How do you ensure that you're getting, you know, like a big bank dividend yield versus one that may be super, super high, but also super, super risky?
I think a lot of it came down to when I was working with my own kids. If they couldn't put it on one page.
So for our radio listeners, Pavi just showed me a couple of pages of, it would almost look like infographics you were showing me there.
Yeah, they just started coloring. Like the first one we did was BCE. That was a stock that they wanted to purchase. And mainly because, through the various partnerships, they own the Raptors and, you know, our cell phone plans are through BCE. And then, you know, I said, like, let's start with the basics. And, you know, my older son was taking accounting in grade 11 by that time. So just putting down the basics, you know, what's the market cap? How much is the profits? When was the first dividend issued with BCE? I mean, the first one was 1881. So what are the chances they're going to cut the dividend or stop it altogether? So those kinds of sort of facts. And usually once they did that, if they were to explain it in one page, we're like, it's good. Let's invest.
There are a lot of pop culture references in your book, Tony Stark, Superman, Doctor Strange. If you were to choose one, which one would you choose and what concept would you demonstrate with that character?
I think the lesson learned for the one that really stuck with my boys is probably Doctor Strange. Because in the movie, because that's the one we could easily make reference to. You know, he went from living the high life in New York City as a surgeon. Hands get crushed, and then, you know, a few minutes later, he's penniless in Nepal. Well, that was one of the references where I hit them, like, you know, had he invested his money, he probably would have had passive income, and that probably would have helped him out a little bit. Like, you know, Tony Starks and Batman were basically gone, whether 3 months or 6 years, and guess what? They make a call, they get their private jet, they come back in, they haven't missed a beat. So there's a big difference between passive income and going and working every day, and then once that salary income stops, what do you do? So I think that kind of hit them at a young age.
For all parents, and more so for some than others, teaching kids about delayed gratification is a huge challenge. Like, we want people to invest both in, you know, financial markets, but also in their education and in their physical and mental health. How do you navigate the challenge of thinking long-term for a human brain that is not yet fully formed?
I think there's some things that we can do. Like for one of the things I did is when I subscribed to the Globe and Mail, so I got my sons to, it comes in every day, print edition, it's not online version. And what they basically have to do is take out their articles and they have to basically highlight, you know, what they thought was interesting, how did it apply to their stock, where are some other investing ideas. And usually, you know, they'll read it for about an hour, mark it all up, and then, okay, you know, I think that was good. And what that started to do was they weren't so concerned about the daily movements of the stock prices of the stocks that they own. And they started thinking a little bit more longer term because, you know, investing is reading, thinking, doing nothing, reading, thinking, doing nothing. And then maybe in a year, one to two trades and that's it. And that's what I try to do. So even if we're losing money on some stocks, I still say, you know, you're not really losing money. You're learning something. So, you know, we're not going to sell. And then you're going to see if your story changes.
Who did this for you? So you're clearly making a difference for the kids in your home and for the kids who read this book. Who is your money mentor? Or did you learn this stuff the hard way?
I learned it the hard way, but I think books do help. I remember when I was in high school, this is back in the late 90s, one of our teachers brought in the book, The Wealthy Barber. So that kind of opened your eyes up to, you know, investing, saving, just the basics. And then when I was in university and I was on the business program, the book that probably had the biggest impact, and I still have the book that I bought in 1997, was Peter Lynch's Beating the Street. And the reason why that stuck to me was, especially that one chapter where he works with these kids from grade 7 from a local elementary school, and they happen to pick some stocks that did very well and that beat out the professional money managers and doing sort of the same thing that I just talked about. So I still kept that book, and I use a lot of that as reference for my own book, and I make reference to that book. So that was probably a big one. And from there, just kept reading more and more books. And you learn by doing, right? It's one of those things where people say, well, should we teach financial literacy in schools? I'm like, yeah, you should. They have accounting classes and everything else. But I also think this is one of those things that investment clubs will probably teach kids a lot more, especially when there's real money involved, even if it's just $100. And yeah, so that's where I learned. I bought my first stock was, my first two stocks were AT&T and Cisco in 1997.
Wow.
So I had a nice run.
Do you still hold them? Do you still hold AT&T and Cisco?
I sold those and I got into that tech fever like everyone else did. And I thought I was smart making money off, you know, Nortel networks and
MGI software.
Yeah. So we lost money, got humble, learned some lessons. Then I thought I got smart again. Then the great financial crisis hit. But yeah. I think after that, I finally said, okay, I've been through two of these. Maybe these guys are right. Maybe just stick to dividends and go slow, buy sea and rail. And, you know, you still need railways, right? So things like that is what I started to focus in on then.
We don't have your sons beside you today, but if they were here, what do you think they would say about your engagement in this particular topic? I mean, once we got over the, ugh, that is so annoying, what would they say the benefits are of this?
I think for us personally, what started to click for them was when we raised enough money in the Young Guns Weightlifting Club, and then we started investing that money, and they realized when the dividends started coming in, and they realized, hey, we made double the money off dividends than we did off the entire year of fundraising. And I don't have to go door to door and sell merchandise. I don't have to sell my protein donuts, you know, at the local fair. I don't have to do, you know, parking at a music festival. We did that too. And yeah, like, wow, they just come in. And we don't need to do anything other than that. We just read. So I think that was the point where I merged Young Guns and this book and the ideals I thought of. So finally, they got it. And they're like, yeah, I think we're good now. This makes sense.
They don't have to sell the protein donuts, but I hope they still get to eat the protein donuts with the money they've earned from dividend paying stocks.
Yeah. Well, they enjoy their donuts. That's for sure.
I enjoy my donuts. Pavi Tur, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Bruce. It was a pleasure.
Pavi Tur is a founder of Young Guns Weightlifting and Boxing Club, which you may wonder what the holy heck that has to do with money, but it gave birth to a philosophy and a book called Learn to Invest Kid, or Learn to Invest Kid. Coming up, Kids and Money Hard. Talking about finances with a spouse can be even harder. One way to do it is by going on a regular money date. Maybe less romantic than a trip to the movies or a fancy dinner out, but very practical. Vanessa Bowen is a money coach and founder of Mintworthy. She's here to talk about how these money dates work. If you want to find out more about money and relationships, money and kids, money and any of the very broad connections we can make when we think about this topic, look at our podcast episodes. We have done, years and years of interviews, lots of conversations. To look at our archive, you just need to go to moolala.ca and you can listen online on the site. You can search by guest, by topic. You can also do a similar search on all of the podcast platforms, Spotify, Apple Music, Amazon Music, all those sorts of things. Moolala, Money Made Simple, is brought to you in part by MNP Debt, specializing in personal bankruptcy, consumer proposals, and debt help. They're Canada's largest consumer insolvency firm, and they've been around for 60 years. 60 years of experience helping Canadians break the cycle of debt. MNP has 80, more than 80 local licensed insolvency trustees serving more than 240 resident satellite offices across the country. Your first step towards a debt-free future, sitting down with one of those folks, one of those licensed insolvency trustees for a free confidential consultation. MNP Debt, life-changing debt solutions that work. Their website, mnpdebt.ca, mnpdebt.ca. Talking about money in a relationship can be uncomfortable. Really, really important to do it, but it can be hard to get started. Sometimes, you know, you can get a little activated by things that are shared. One way to provide a structure and a frequency is to have something called a money date. And I saw a newsletter in which a money expert guy, Ramit Sethi, was talking about money dates. And I thought we should bring on one of our people, Vanessa Bowen, to talk about this. She is a chartered professional accountant. She is money coach. She's the founder of Mintworthy Co. And she's going to talk about what money dates mean for her and how to do them effectively. Hello there.
Hello, Bruce. Thanks for having me.
The phrase money date can mean lots of different things to different people. What does it mean to you?
Yeah, essentially what I coin it as is a date with money. So it actually doesn't even matter about your physical relationship. Yes, of course, if you're in a relationship and you're a couple, it's going to be you, your partner, and money. But if you're single, you still need to date your money and have a date with just you and money, because money knows everyone. It's not biased to who you are. So when I say money date, it's you having this intentional time to look at your finances and actually be with money and be with your financial goals.
And with what frequency optimally should one be having a money date?
I would say at least bi-weekly. I know sometimes people will say, oh, wait till the end of the month, but that's you being more reactive versus if you have it at least bi-weekly, you can be more proactive. If like your spending has been a little crazy, maybe because of the holidays.
You're listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Make those proactive changes to change your spending before the month ends instead of you ending the month and being like, oops, it's too late.
I love how you say oops. I'd be like, you're a light oops. I'm up. Let me ask you, what are some of the topics that should be covered on a money date?
Yeah, such a great question. I think first and foremost, you got to look at where you're at versus your financial goals. Hopefully you've set some. So looking at, you know, how far have you come? Do you need to maybe course correct, or there's some adjustments, or maybe your life has taken a shift. Maybe you've had a big life change and now you have to change the goals that you set at the beginning of the year or a month ago. And I think also what's very important, you know, if you do have a budget, especially nowadays, you know, we've got inflation and food prices and mortgage rates and all the things. People are trying to be more of a smart spender. So looking at your spending and your budget versus what you had planned and seeing if you can adjust there. And then one kind of, I'll say, different topic that I like to throw in is your mindset or that emotional component of money. Like, what fears are you feeling? What stressors are you having around money? Like, definitely talk about that, especially with your partner, because if you don't, I always say that could lead to financial infidelity.
Ooh, what do you mean by financial infidelity?
Well, you know, Bruce, when you like go and you shop, but you
have any idea.
I'm not saying what? You specifically,
you mean the second credit card that I have that Dennis knows nothing about?
Yes, yeah. Okay. That one,
all right.
You know.
Okay.
Yeah.
So Sethi has a very organized agenda when he talks about money dates and a duration. I couldn't believe he's got to have like 5 minutes to celebrate. I don't know, 7 minutes to review last month, a certain number of minutes to plan for next month. What do you think of that approach? Are you agenda oriented or are you kind of free flow?
I'm more free flow, you know, like definitely my husband and I have our money dates every Sunday morning. So we set aside an hour, but there's no specific agenda because I think every week it changes, especially with where our life is at or where our goals are at or what investments we want to shift and change. So we set the specific time, but then the agenda is really just us diving in. We definitely look at where our spending or where our money has gone versus our budget, where we're at versus the plan, but there's no like set agenda inside of that hour time frame.
How did the money dates, I'm going to use the partner example here. How did those money dates evolve over time? So you are a relatively new parent. Hooray for you. Congratulations.
Thank you.
I can imagine that there are things that you talk about, things that you are fearful about, that when you did not have a child sleeping and snoring nearby, you didn't think so much about. How do you think those money dates evolve over time?
Yeah, that's such a great point. And they've definitely evolved. Now we're looking at, like, we actually in our budget have a separate line for our daughter, like Aria, like how much are we spending on her, on like diapers and like all of those things. And when she gets older, for childcare. So definitely I would say our money dates have shifted to then obviously incorporate her, but also look at, okay, what's the impact now of having a child on our goals? Do we need to maybe shift one or two of our, you know, future goals to accommodate putting her in like Montessori or private school sooner rather than later? Like all these things that I was not thinking about just, you know, 9 months ago really shifted like where we're spending our money and also like how we're saving and how we're investing. It's definitely more intentionality in terms of like what we're doing as a family.
When you think about the word date in a relationship context, it's like, oh, we're going to go for a walk at the beach. We're going to go see a Hollywood blockbuster. We're going for dinner. Like it's really connotes this very positive feeling. Some of the topics on money are not so positive, right? There could be something that's happened in the preceding week that you need to use this as an opportunity to address with your partner. What are some ways into something, bringing something up that might be contentious, that might be fraught?
Yeah, it's a great point. And I think it starts with like that, setting that base of what this money date is for. And for me and my husband, for instance, we already know there's no judgment. There's no judgment zone. Like whatever we have to deal with together as a family. And it's literally attacking all of that straight on and being honest and not judging the other person. And I think if you can create that more honest and open environment, it really takes away that fear or pressure coming into your money date. It's almost like, okay, finally I get to voice all of this. I've been holding this in for the week. Like, this is how I'm feeling, or this is what I'm worried about. I think if you can create that inside of your partnership and relationship, money dates become super fun. Like I get excited to like sit down and be like, okay, here's where we maybe need to shift, or here's where we need to pass, but like, let's do it. And I think also it brings you together in your partnership and in your relationship as well.
Who takes notes in your money date? If there's items to catalog, I love that you're smiling and laughing here. Who takes notes?
You know, it's not me. It's actually my husband. Yeah, it's not me. And he'll like send an email after. So yeah, I'm not
this
that
is
one.
The summary of our conversation and you agreed to. Thank you so much.
Yeah, if there's things that have to be done, yep, he'll email me. Make sure you do this because, you know, I forget.
Right. One of the things that we talk a lot about at Credit Canada is money habits. So there are things that are point in time decisions. There's things that you do every once in a while, but what seems to matter more are the habits that you have that you do every day or every week. How does that weave into some of the systemic things that a couple or a family might need to alter in order to achieve those goals that you're talking about?
Yeah, it's so true. And it can be difficult to create a habit around having a money date, especially from the beginning. I always say try to make it fun, but always think of what's the end goal here. Like this is really for you and your partner to become one or get on one page and actually achieve your financial goals. You know, so many times we'll say this is what we want to do, but we don't do it. And having that money date is that actual designated intentional time to do the thing, to look at your money, to shift your spending. And when you think of it like that, for me, I would say it really puts you more connected to the purpose behind the date. And it makes the habit or creation of the habit easier because you're more focused on that end goal, not that like, oh my gosh, I have to sit here and talk about money. Think about the end goal, always the end goal.
You are in the mode here. You've got a pattern and a habit of doing this with your partner. That's great. Many of our listeners will be like, I would love to do that, Vanessa, but my partner will not even show up. Like he or she will cancel. He or she will find any excuse to not have this conversation. what would you say to their yeah buts?
Yeah, such a great question, Bruce. One, first, have the conversation with your partner. If they're still reluctant, here's actually what one of my clients did. They just had the money date with themselves. So she literally met every Saturday with her partner watching her and looked at their finances and, you know, made these decisions. And then, of course, you know, there's FOMO, right? Her partner's like, okay, well, like, how are we doing? Like, are we hitting the mark with our savings? And then eventually he came in and he's obviously one a part of it now and loves it. So definitely have the conversation, share why it's important to you. But if they're not on board, don't wait. Do it yourself. And
do it yourself.
Me, they won't
and
come
probably
on board.
Probably think about your partner's favorite treat.
Yes.
Buy only one of that treat and then sit in the same room while you begin to nibble at the fresh chocolate croissant that he or she would really love to have and say, oh my gosh, I'm so sorry. This particular treat is only for those who are attending the money date. Right?
Yes, exactly. I love that.
Vanessa, congratulations on parenthood, and thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Bruce. Thank you for having me.
Vanessa Bowen, chartered professional accountant, money coach, founder of Mintworthy. She was here to talk about money dates, and she's pretty good at this. We should listen to everything she says. That's it for our show today. A thank you to our sponsors, Credit Canada, the first and longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency in the country. If you have thoughts about the show today, feedback, comments, ideas, questions, you can send us an email to ask@moolala.ca. ask@moolala.ca. If you want to stay up to date on all things Moolala, our newsletter is available at moolala.ca. And once you subscribe, we promise we will never do anything with your address other than send you said newsletter. On the various podcast platforms, you can subscribe there and get the podcast version of the show delivered right to your device. You'll also be able to leave us a review, which will help other people discover the show. On social media, I am at Bruce Celery on X, Bruce Celery Moolala on Facebook. Thank you so much for listening and have a great day.